Hello, Bonsai friends. This is Evan Pardue of Underhill Bonsai, and welcome to episode 75 of Little Things for Bonsai People. It is the year of the Wood Dragon, 2024, and this time I am joined by one of my co-hosts, Carmen Lesko-Viensky. How's it going today, Carmen?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Doing all right. For some reason, I'm feeling a little under the weather today. I'm not sure why.
You did just host like a huge show and then like didn't really take a break. So you're probably just like tired.
Yeah, I think I'm in this weird transition right now where I went straight into attempting to prep all of my trees for the upcoming shows and the travel that I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I did spend all day yesterday doing that during the eclipse, which at the time of this recording have been earlier this week. So they had the solar eclipse. It was all over the news if you missed it. I don't know what you were doing that day, but most people knew about it. And I was not in a spot where you could even see anything. I mean,
that stinks. I know. We could see like a quarter of it, but it was kind of cloudy. And so like I noticed it got a little bit dark, but I was kind of jealous of my East Coast friends who like had a full on eclipse.
Yeah. It was way too overcast. It actually rained like all day. Yeah. And so I was out with a raincoat and a wide brim hat on, like wiring and trimming my trees in place because I didn't want to move some of them because some were big.
Yeah.
But yeah, it did get really dark around like lunchtime. So it was like 12 to 1 here in Louisiana. And like it was raining so much that you wouldn't have known the difference between the rain clouds and the eclipse. But, you know, it was awesome. I know a couple people saw it, and it's like a once-in-a-lifetime thing for us, because I think, wasn't it like several hundred years?
No, I think we get another one in 20 years.
Oh, well, not too far away. So we're doing okay. We got time.
We're doing all right.
Yeah. But yeah, I know some people drove all the way up to Texas. I heard that a lot of people were flying in all over the world to East Texas and North Texas to catch it. And then they were saying how like there was overcast skies that day, like came out of nowhere and people were like freaking out. But yeah,
that's too bad.
But yeah, anyway, so today's topic is going to be another
science
series. So science with some echoes there, I'm sure. So this time on the
science
series, we're going to talk about water uptake in plants and how plants basically take the water from their soil and up into the different parts and use it for whatever plants do with water. We don't know yet. Carmen's going to fill us in on that. She is our studied college graduate in horticulture and stuff. So she's going to give us plenty of stuff to think about throughout the week about how to grow our plants, how to care for our bonsai, breaking down the
science
and the cool little things that we don't think about when we're growing our trees. So she also done, what was the previous one?
We did photosynthesis. We did like part of it. We didn't go through all of it.
We covered a good chunk of stuff, though.
We did. Yeah.
So if you guys want to go back and refer back to, can't remember the episode. Let me look it up really quick. It was episode 65. You can go back to the first part of this.
Oh, man, that's like 10 episodes ago.
That was literally perfect. 10 episodes ago.
Wow. Okay, we'll try to get these more like every 4 or 5 episodes instead of every 10.
No big rush. I mean, that was only...
It was a busy season.
That was only earlier this year in February, so it's only April now, so it's not a big deal, I don't think. Okay. And we might even go back and revisit some of that later on. Like you said, photosynthesis has more stuff to cover, so... But before we get into any of that, I want to mention that our podcast is sponsored by our amazing patrons over at patreon.com/littlethingsforbonsaipeople. Head over there and become a bonsai best bud, or you can hang out in the Discord with those people. You don't have to become a best bud. You can become a bonsai friend as well at $1 level. Bonsai best bud is at the $3 level. $5 level. I'm sorry. So we have a new bonsai best bud with Joseph Dominique. So thank you so much, Joseph.
Yeah. What up?
Yep. Welcome to the group. I'm sending out a Discord invite to you and you can hang out. We chat bonsai. Thank you so much for supporting at that level. Every little bit counts and every little bit really helps us get along here. and it supplies us with coffee and bonsai wire and the willingness to go out and work on trees every day. And so I have a featured best bud of the week. Our featured best bud of the week is going to be Justin Knight. So I just take a random grab of our bonsai best buds and just kind of call back to our earlier subscribers. So thank you so much, Justin, for subscribing and supporting us for too long. He's been a supporter for over a
since
year
the
now.
Beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. Very long time. Thank you so much, Justin. And then of course we have our main show sponsor, Joshua Roth Tools. John and the company supply the United States with really great high quality Japanese tools and also mid-range all the way down to something a little bit more affordable. He also carries the Ryuga brand. I mean, they have a little bit of everything. They're just all around a great company to buy your lifelong tools on. They also have a 3-year warranty on their tools. I found this out first when we got them. Carry them at Underhill, and also we have some deals through Little Things Here. So yeah, some really good stuff there from Joshua Roth. And then we have our specimen best buds, Unrai Yuen, Christina Corforia, and also Bill's Bayou. Thank you so much for subscribing at that level. And then can't go much further without thanking our editor, Matt O'Donnell. He makes us sound smart, cleans up our audio, makes us enjoyable to listen to. So go over to mattodonnell.com and fill out a form on his previous episode that we had. He was on the show with us. Apparently he doesn't have a form, but you can email him on from his website. If you want to start up your own podcast and audio engineering project with him, he's a set basis living in Nashville, Tennessee. He's an all around awesome guy. It's in the script to say it every single time. And go listen to Matt O'Donnell Wants to Know, his own podcast show that he talks to apparently people in various different careers, and also people in the music industry, and people that he wants to get to know and know what's their why their career and their life is so interesting. So he wants to know. That's why he calls it that. So yeah, we were talking a little bit about, was there anything on photosynthesis that you wanted to bring up that you may have kind of missed on earlier?
I mean, there's just there's like a whole set of plants that do things a little bit differently. They're called like the CAM plants, but like that can be a whole discussion on its own. So just more nuances, really, not anything huge that I missed. I mean, the general gist of it all is, you know, plants take in carbon dioxide and water and make sugar. So,
yeah. And so like the water uptake part of this will be the basically the next part of it, because they have to take in the light and then it transfers energy and the sugars back down to the root system. And so the water is kind of like the other thing that we're looking for to kind of make the whole thing work, because photosynthesis can function, but you can't do without H2O, from my understanding.
Exactly. Yes.
So I don't know.
Water is a huge component.
So it has to. Okay. So just kind of give us a light summary of the photosynthesis process up to the point when the water starts to matter. Just a quick.
Okay. So at what point is water important for photosynthesis?
Yes.
In the photosynthesis reaction, it's 6 carbon dioxide plus 12 water, which gives you your sugar. So it is 100% necessary for any kind of sugar to be created for the plant. So right from the beginning, we need water. Plants are about 95% water. So without it in that capacity, there just really wouldn't be plants either. So just super important all around. And as bonsai practitioners, I think we're all aware of the how hard watering can be. And hopefully this will help you figure out why it's so important to get your watering correct. But just to kind of demystify how plants, you know, take up water and move it through their whole systems. So should I just jump right in here?
Yeah. And it kind of makes me think. So for the process of photosynthesis, and then the water just has to be present. From what I'm gathering so far, it just has to be present immediately. Otherwise, photosynthesis really can't happen at all. So,
right.
Okay, so we're just kind of building off of that. It's kind of like doing college algebra where you just keep building on top of each section you learn.
Right.
So, But and
yeah,
I know. Oh, go
sorry, go
ahead.
ahead. No, you finish. Sorry.
Now, I was just thinking, like, with the soil and the way that we water, this can all obviously they're going to pick up the water, whether it be the, just basic garden soil versus bone-size soil. That's a preferred mix or composition of like media, like soil media. So, and will all those things kind of affect the way this happens, I'm sure.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the specific mechanisms and then all of the things, all of there's like, so outside of just how the plant operates, there's all these biological and non-biological factors that influence it, right? So your soil type, if there's pathogens, what the light intensity is, what the weather's, all this stuff is going to affect how plants are going to take up the water and move it around. But the mechanisms from plant to plant are pretty much the same. So, essentially, water enters through the root hairs of roots. So, the fine roots, which is what we really try to get a lot of in bonsai, have the best absorption of water. So that's the really fine roots, and then they put out these root hairs, which are like single cellular fuzzy bits that kind of come off of those really fine roots, and these are the most permeable, and so they're going to absorb the most water. But because we're dealing with a lot of woody plants, and you see this a lot in forests too, so roots will often get some kind of barky as they get older, and they are not as permeable as those really fine roots, which is again why we try to get so many of those in our bonsai pots. But even the woody roots are fairly permeable. So even the trees and forests, with a lot of the big woody roots exposed on the top, can absorb some water. But I mean, we're just coming out of repotting season right now, and so everybody's probably had a chance to see some really nice root tips, see some fine roots, and again, that's really why we try to cultivate those the most.
I didn't know that the, because you have it on your notes that the larger roots, even though they become woody, they can still take up a good amount of moisture.
Yeah, they can.
Which I've always just kind of thought of like, okay, I'm just gonna take out as many of the horse fruits as possible and knock down to and cut back to feeder roots, but it's still not even a bad thing to have those big roots under the soil, is what I'm gathering.
Well, I mean, they still take up water, but they're not as efficient as the fine roots. So you really only need the big roots, for structural support or, to make your Nabari look good. But if you think of like, if you're collecting a pine off of the side of a mountain and it has like three or four thick, woody-ish roots and maybe a tiny handful of little feeder roots, I mean, it's able to sustain itself with the roots that it has, even though it doesn't have very many. So, yeah, the woody roots still can absorb water, but the fine roots are better at it, especially with nutrient absorption. So that's why we really want those instead. And you can fit more fine roots in a pot than big, thick roots. But yeah, even so, those big woody roots still will take up some water.
That's interesting because, like, that might help some people. Like you said, when you collect a pine or a juniper from the, from an area where there's a lot of bigger roots and barely any, like, small, finer roots, that might help some people imagine how caring for those larger roots is still very important after collection and then repotting and stuff after we get a good amount of roots on a tree. And I feel like we could talk about just root systems all day
Oh,
as
yeah.
opposed to just how they take up the water. So it's just like it kind of I think it will play into like we could do a whole episode on the anatomy of a root system.
Oh,
And
totally.
yeah, and I would literally like that because like to me personally, like I think that the root system is the most important part. Probably the whole part, most important part of the bonsai. So like people will probably heard me say this a lot, like whenever I give classes or workshops or anything, that I usually harp on that. And so, you know, that also will play into this. And we can add, like we said, we can add on to it as we go. But yeah, don't let me get too far away from some of the terminology I see you had going on here that's going to help us understand that further.
Sure. Well, I mean, also, it kind of helps you imagine, too, when you take a cutting or if you have to dig a plant out of a field and, like, you don't have a lot of fine root, you just kind of end up with this kind of block of wood. You know, some of what's there can still absorb that water, even though it doesn't have super fine roots. But, it'll grow them and replace the roots that it lost. But it kind of helps you visualize, too, why some of these things are possible. So Mike was mentioning this in an episode a while back, but it's called hydrotropism. So this is the ability of roots to grow from drier areas of the soil to wetter areas of the soil. So this is just a really interesting phenomenon. I was thinking about it today in regards to repotting and how when we repot something, you know, you have your core and then you have all this soil around that core and you water based on the core of the old core. So if your old soil is dry, you water whether or not the new soil is wet or dry. But I'm thinking that, you know, sometimes that new soil is still wet and that core is dry, so you water it. But what's happening there is that that dry core, you know, the roots there are dry, but the soil out there is outside of it is wet. So it's really encouraging some of those new roots to grow out into that wet area of soil. Which I hadn't really considered before, but kind of interesting when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But this is another reason why you don't want to necessarily overwater your trees, because you want your roots to continue growing. And so if if they always have a ton of water available, they won't necessarily need to, you know, keep looking for it. You don't want to, you know, put your plant through drought stress, but you know, letting them have that kind of dry period between waterings will help your roots grow and find more sources of water within your soil. So,
because functionally, that's how some like older trees that are starting to adapt to their location in the ground would be, is that there has to be spots of dry areas, because otherwise they will not send out their running roots in seeking out other water sources.
Yeah. So, I mean, the roots will still grow if the plant needs more root area to absorb water and nutrients, still grow. But, this is for plants that, you know, aren't particularly water loving, just kind of your standard plant. Cause some plants grow in water and that's a different story, but generally speaking, having some dry areas, allowing your plants to dry down does encourage roots to kind of, you know, reach out. It also creates some curvature in the roots sometimes as the plant is looking for water. You know, one part of the cell elongates and the other doesn't, which kind of causes it to curve or whatever. So I feel like we could probably do a whole episode on hydrotropism too. When I was reading about it, it seems like this mechanism isn't 100% understood yet, but they're starting to be able to see it happening under microscopes and that kind of thing. So they're still trying to figure out those mechanisms. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking about it's getting away from me. I was going to mention, drying down. You just mentioned drying down a second ago. For our listeners that are not familiar with that term, I've used that terminology with another bonsai practitioner not too long ago, asking about whether or not a tree needed a dry down period. And that means, and Mike kind of taught me this. So it's kind of like this, these different layers of just like me regurgitating is basically what it is, but basically just telling the next person. And it's a very helpful way to think about the way that trees dry out as when you water them and then you go throughout the day, we call it drying down, because the top of the soil tends to dry faster than the bottom, because moisture gathers at the bottom of the container easier, it stays there longer. Also, the plant being over it prevents a lot of that moisture from escaping. But if the plant's not absorbing that water, then it's not going to dry as quickly. So the likelihood that your tree will dry from the top going downwards towards the actual bottom of the pot, it's more likely that you'll find it drier there. So we call it, it's drying down from the top to the bottom. And like you said, Carmen, it seems that letting it dry down will encourage those roots to go into those areas more often. But we also, like we had mentioned a few episodes back about top dressing, will also encourage finer roots to not die back in those areas where they're okay. Basically would be air pruned off. But yeah,
right.
I just wanted to kind of reiterate that because I think that's really interesting. That's taught me a lot about repotting techniques and stuff. But yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, you're fine. I feel like I had a, you know, going through school for horticulture definitely has given me an advantage with this, all the plant science stuff, just because, you know, 4 years of it, whatever. But if you go to a nursery and you get like a 4-inch pot of, like, I don't know, a pansy or whatever, a geranium, and you just pull it out of the pot, and if it hasn't been watered, you know, just like if it's not soaking wet, you can kind of see too within that garden soil of, like, you know, where the water is. And if the plant is growing really well, you'll see the root hairs. You don't see this as much on the woody plants. You don't see the root hairs as much, but on herbaceous plants, like your common garden annuals, you can see really beautiful root hairs. And it seems to me that there are more root hairs and more root divisions in plants that are watered properly, which does require a dry down period in between. So yeah, it's, if you go to, I mean, now's a great time to go to your garden center and, you know, look at the roots of an herbaceous plant, and you'll see there exactly what we're talking about with root hairs and all of that. So just I remember in my classes just pulling things out of pots and looking at the roots and being like, wow, this is so cool. So even now, like, I was potting up some pansies the other day and I was like, wow, look at these roots. They're so beautiful. It's so silly. It's ridiculous.
But yet seeing good roots, like understanding that there's certain things that you need to see whenever you're having a healthy root system develop and pulling those out and looking at that. That's one of the things that we actually do during this time of year. We're a little bit later now. I know you guys are still repotting and lower
we're
zones.
We're at the tail end. Yeah.
Yeah. And so lower number zones, you guys can still pull trees out and inspect the root systems, look for growing tips and see if it's time. That's one way I know. That's one of the ways I know for here, Japanese black pines, we check them that way. Japanese black pines, we'll pull them out of the pot slightly and then we'll see if there's white growing tips. And that's the signal that it's time to do repotting. Huh. And that's a good way to look at that too. Whereas some other plants, it's not as obvious, that don't have nearly as coarse roots, but have much finer roots. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's an exciting time of the year.
Yeah, well, we should post some photos of root tips and root hairs on the Instagram to go along with this episode. I have some great pictures I can share.
Yeah, definitely.
So we'll do that. So water flows through some parts of the plant easier than others. So, right, you get a lot of uptake easily through the root because that's where, you know, the plant absorbs the most water is through those root cells. But as the water moves through the plant, there's one particular kind of tissue called xylem. So I think we're all familiar with xylem and phloem, but xylem is the specialized plant tissue that moves water up through the plant. So phloem generally moves nutrients kind of downwards from the canopy to the roots and, you know, throughout the plant, whatever, laterally. But xylem is the tissue that pulls the water up from the roots all the way up to the leaves. So water can't, you know, coming into the plant, sometimes it has to go through a number of layers of cells, working its way into the xylem. But once it gets into the xylem, there's no resistance there. The cells that create the xylem go through, so they start out as living cells, and then they undergo something called programmed cell death, where essentially the cell dies and forms a hollow tube so that the water can move freely up the tube without having to, you know, go through all of the layers of cell walls and cell membranes and, you know, trying to get through all this other stuff to get where it needs to go. And there's two kinds of tubes within the xylem. There's tracheids, which are generally found in the leaves. They're smaller and they're tapered on each end. So like kind of like a grain of rice, I guess, would be a good visual. And then the vessels, these are the individual cells that are stacked up on top of one another that form the continuous tube through the whole stem and into the leaf. Yeah. So I think most of us generally think of xylem as the vessel elements. So, you know, those long tubes, like in celery, you know, when you get the string, like that's the xylem you're pulling out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the tracheids, those are generally in the leaves, much smaller, but they hold the water there. So once the water goes up into the root, it goes through the xylem, all the way up to the leaf stalk, which is also called the petiole. If you're looking at your leaf, you know how you have the midrib, the vein there, and then all the little veins going off of it. The water kind of disperses there through the leaf into the tracheids and then goes and does whatever else it's going to do in the leaf. So,
yeah, that kind of draws together the whole vascular system now, is what you can call that, right? Yeah.
Yep.
So I try to talk about the xylem and the phloem whenever we're talking about where this layer of the bark, or it's the layer of like the tree's skin, essentially. And it's kind of hard to remember the difference between the xylem and the phloem. Do you have any like little sayings or little things that you can think of that kind of help? Like would help our listeners remember the difference between this, because I get like really caught up like trying to be, someone's like, oh, what's xylem and phloem, what does that mean? I'm like, well, that's where the tree's vascular system is, and that's where nutrient uptake is, but I don't know which one goes which direction. So is there something you can help remember?
I don't have a little saying, and I wish I did. I'm gonna Google it real quick and see if there's anything fun.
Yeah. So, because
xylem and phloem saying, yeah.
But yeah, the way that the cambium, so the cambium is what contains those two layers, correct?
Yeah.
So is there other things going on in that cambium layer, or is it just strictly xylem and phloem?
Oh, that's a great question. Off the top of my head, have no idea. I would have to look that up.
Yeah. I was just wondering if, like, because it's one of the things that it's kind of hard to think about when you are cutting off a branch, or let's say you have a spot where you're like, oh, I'm going to create a hollow here, or I'm going to take the wood off and I'm going to do, you know, X, Y, and Z different techniques and different things. If you disrupt the phloem in the xylem layer of the cambium, so some trees are able to make that, basically take that that damage and then make use of that tissue still, and some are not able to do that as easily. So we call it, like, on bonsai, we kind of use this term called live vein, and it's easier to tell people that the live vein of the tree is where the water and the nutrients moves. And if you sever that live vein, then obviously but it will become obvious as you think about it more that live vein being severed will not be able to get to the leaves, which is our photosynthesis, our energy, little energy factories carrying the nutrient and then the water back up again. So I'm just trying to think of a creative way to remember the difference between those two. And then, Carmen, do you have anything to be said about, like, if there's a disruption in the xylem and phloem, what happens there? Or is it just like an open wound? You know, do you know much about that?
Yeah. So I have some stuff on that.
A little bit further down, huh?
A little bit further down, but I can jump to that right now.
I'm just wondering. Yeah. It's something that comes to mind.
So, when there's a break in the xylem, what happens is it creates like a little embolism, so like a little air pocket, and this is called cavitation. And so what can happen, so this often occurs during either freezing, because when water turns to ice, air is forced out of, you know, the solution there. So you can get a little air pocket. Or during drought, you can get water, or I mean, a little air pocket in the xylem as well. And so this can just be like a little bubble, or it can fully kind of be a bubble across the entire xylem, and it can essentially break the water column. So the water moving from the soil all the way up to the leaves, it creates a disruption there. Some plants can work around it. They can like reroute the water, or they can like water from the phloem or other tissue can kind of come in and fill some of that gap and, you know, create a new pathway. But if the plant is unable to do that, then that bit of tissue will end up dying. And so during drought or freezing, this can be a much bigger issue when you get too much air into the xylem. You know, it can cause, if it's just, you know, if it's one vein of xylem, whatever, if it's the whole stem or a whole branch or whatever, then you're in big trouble and you're going to have a lot of plant death. So, yeah, that can be a big problem.
So you can get a freeze or harsh enough cold weather that will cause those capillaries to burst is what I'm kind of getting from that too.
So there's a couple ways that the freezing can be damaging. So if the solution, so like, you know, plant nutrients moving through the phloem or throughout the rest of the plant, when they freeze, they can then they crystallize and they can damage, you know, the cell walls and actually physically, you know, damage your plant, which is then not able to repair itself. But within the xylem, the freezing or the drought can cause just air pockets, essentially, which doesn't necessarily cause physical damage. It just creates a blockage. There's a couple other things that can cause blockages too. So pathogens, if they are in the xylem, or if they create something that's in the xylem, or if they eat across, if they like girdle the tree, essentially, then the water cannot physically move from the bottom to the top. Or when the plant has a pathogen or an insect or a pest or whatever, sometimes they'll create sap or, you know, some kind of substance to try and compartmentalize that wound. And that can sometimes also block that section of xylem. So physical barriers, animals or other organisms physically separating that, or air pockets are the things really that can disrupt the xylem.
Oh, hey, Carmen, did I tell you about Bonsai Central yet?
No, I don't think you have.
Oh, I think I might have mentioned it a few other times, but it's going to be May 3rd through 5th in 2024 in St. Louis, Missouri. It's basically the national show, but it's going to be Central America, and it's going to be an awesome show with cash awards and prizes. There's going to be a professional bonsai show and a kusumono show as well.
Ooh.
With the presentation during dinner with for rewards and whatnot. But if you want to submit a tree, I think you have to submit 2 to 4 photos, and you need a brief description of your tree and send it over to the contact form at bonsaicentral.com. That's bonsai-central.com. But I think there's going to be vendors there too. Do you know what vendors were included? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I heard that it's going to be something like 25 plus of the best vendors from around the country. So like including nurseries, potters, stand makers, tool suppliers, and all of that.
But like specifically, I thought I heard that there was going to be American potters. Like,
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, now Tochu Take is going to be there. Vicky Chamberlain, Eli Atkins of Waldo Street Pottery, Abel Grigsby, Roy Minari, and Byron Merrick. Sellers of imported Japanese and antique Chinese pots are going to be there, too.
That's amazing. I mean, there must be, like, a pretty good lineup for this show as far as, like, their headliners. There should be some really good bonsai artists. Do you have any idea who that might be? I think I might have heard about Bjorn, but there's some other ones, right?
Oh, yeah, Bjorn's going to be there. Tyler Sherrod as well. Maria Hayek, Andrew Robson, Mauro Stemberger, and Young Cho.
Oh.
I think there's going to be workshops, show walkthroughs, critiques, all that stuff.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. There should be somewhere to go on bonsai-central.com, and you can fill out the opportunities to do workshops with these professionals. They have really great material, I've heard. It's going to be stuff like twisted junipers and old fused maples and really awesome pieces of material for Young's Kosumono class. So I think if you guys are interested, y'all should go check out bonsai-central.com and see if you can register for the show, sign up for workshops if they're still available. But I'll definitely be there this year.
Awesome. That's sweet.
Yeah, thank you, Bonsai Central, for sponsoring our show.
Hey, everyone. This is John Eads, founder of Left Coast Bonsai and proud supporter of the Little Things for Bonsai People podcast. I'm breaking into your feed today to let you know about a few exciting things we're doing here at Left Coast Bonsai. We're a small, family-owned bonsai nursery that's focused on producing high-quality bonsai plant material, as well as sourcing hard-to-find supplies for growing in your own yard. For many of us, winter is a time to pause and reflect on the year ahead. Now's a good time to decide what seedlings and supplies you need for the upcoming season. We have a large selection of seedlings that will begin shipping out mid-February for our spring season. You can also order baskets, felt bags, or aluminum wire. In addition to the seedlings and supplies, I also teach classes and study groups on a broad range of subjects, including growing trees from scratch. I hope to hear from you soon and would love to talk about how we can support your bonsai growing journey. You can find us online at leftcoastbonsai.com, on Instagram at leftcoastbonsai, or send me an email at talk@leftcoastbonsai.com. Cheers!
This podcast is supported by Bonsai Bar, the beginner bonsai workshop popping up in breweries all across the Northeast. Bonsai Bar is 2 hours of tiny tree goodness disguised as a night out with friends. Come grab drinks, create a new tree, and watch as your friends and family get the bug for bonsai. Bonsai Bar is always looking for teachers and assistants, and you listen to this podcast, so you're probably already qualified. Bring your knowledge out to the bar. Apply today. Find event tickets, contact info, and more at bonsaibar.com.
So yeah, we can pick back up where you were, because I'm sorry to sidebar you.
No, that's okay.
And put you another part of your notes there.
that's okay. I mean, however it flows naturally is totally fine with me. We'll get to it all.
Yeah. So moving back to the way that the water moves through. Mm-hmm. And so I guess this is kind of like the next part is like, okay, so the trees are not just sucking it up like a straw or like.
Well, kind of.
in a weird way. Because, yeah, you were like, it's like, okay, so the individual vessels that are like stacked little continuous tubes. Uh-huh. And so I know from experience that I have actually like, let's see, there's one plant. In particular, I cut a banana.
Mm-hmm.
So down in New Orleans, every once in a while you'll see actual banana plants growing where mm-hmm. it's a little bit more subtropical. Mm-hmm. And those plants are really efficient at moving water because they grow really fast and mm-hmm. it's a giant stem. Basically, it's not a woody plant. And
yeah.
I've cut a banana on the stock. Like, because for those who are not aware, bananas has like a, it kind of looks like how a palm tree kind of extends. Mm-hmm. And then the leaves can be like 15 feet long. They're ridiculously giant. And then I don't know if you're used to seeing those kind of banana trees.
Oh, yeah.
And then you cut the stalk. And I cut one time and water squirted out at the end of it. Like I cut it like with a pair of really sharp scissors. And so I did mm-hmm. a nice clean cut. And the water spurted out the end of it like a couple of times. Like it was kind of gruesome to think of like, you know, like if you were to cut someone's
arm
off.
Exactly.
And it spurred out. And I was like, oh, shit. Like I hurt this plant. But yeah, there's obviously pressure in there that's causing that to move. It doesn't just, the plant just doesn't just like vacuum it up. There's something else going on there. So I guess that's the next part. It's like, how does that work? That's really it's kind of weird to me because it's creating some kind of pressure there in its own way. So
yeah, so this is really fun. This is called the Soil Plant Atmosphere Continuum, or SPAC.
Okay, I've seen this before, but I don't know if it's for plants. Maybe it was somewhere else, but SPAC. Soil Plant Atmosphere
Continuum. It kind of looks like ASPCA, but it's SPAC.
Yeah, okay, that's
so
where I think I've
that
seen
maybe that's
from.
What it is, because I was looking at it like that looks like ASPCA, but cue the Sarah McLaughlin music.
Yeah, now I know so, where I've seen that before.
So plants don't actively move water the way that people do. Like there's no suction, there's no heart pumping. So they move it passively two ways. One is pressure. The other is chemical potential gradients, or like osmosis, essentially. So pressure is, I think, what we generally think of when we think about plants moving water, and that's transpiration. So water evaporates through the leaves, and this creates negative pressure throughout the plant, and it pulls water up, essentially, through the xylem. So this is also called the cohesion tension mechanism. Because tension is created there, right? As the water's pulled up through evaporation and transpiration, cohesion, because water sticks to itself. It's cohesive to itself, and it does this through the hydrogen bonding.
Too. Okay. Yeah.
So water will stick to itself, and you see this, you know, if you spill a water droplet, it stays as a droplet, and if you put another droplet next to it, it'll stick to the other water droplet and become a bigger droplet. So the hydrogen bonding between water molecules holds water together. And then as the water, so up in the leaves, right, the stomata or the pores in the leaf, they open to let carbon dioxide and oxygen and, you know, gas exchange through the leaf. But this is also where plants lose most of their water, through transpiration. So the water evaporates out of the leaf, and as it evaporates, the hydrogen bonds of the water are broken, and then that tension pulls up more water from below it in the water column. So it's just kind of an actively moving water column from the root, pulled up by the evaporation through the leaf that is transpiration. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's a lot of words all at once.
No, it's I was literally thinking, like, after you said that the water column and then like the negative pressure pull on those vessels is what really pulls the water. I was like, it's so simple.
Right.
But it's so smart. It's like,
okay,
how, like, do, I mean, obviously this is over, you know, I'm
oversimplifying it a little bit.
No,
but...
no, but it's easier to think of that way. I'm thinking of over the period of like several years, decades, eras of like evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where did plants, I mean, and obviously in order to survive, develop, and thrive, that they've already had this. This is something that they've had since the beginning. And so where does the single cell organism that originally existed go from that to how a plant now moves water? It's like, how did the evolutionary split happen right there? You know, that's awesome to think about. Like, how did the plants figure that out when they were much earlier on in development in existence? You know?
It's crazy. It's really weird to think of, because you think about like your non-vascular plants, like your mosses. And so they don't have vascular tissue. They don't have xylem and phloem. The water just kind of
sits on them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it kind of like is just a continual tube or whatever, you know, it's like all osmosis. And that's one of the reasons they can't get tall, really, is because they don't have vascular tissue. So having this is kind of an evolutionary advantage too, because it allows some trees to get much taller because they can pull the water up. They don't have to stay low where the water is. They can expand and get more sunlight and whatever. But yeah, I would love to, I haven't ever, you know, looked that up as to see at what point did the vascular plant start to split off. But yeah, that's a really curious.
Yeah. It's a weird thought.
Curious,
it's
like, question.
It's almost like super science, like sci-fi kind of feeling, like they, like these plants were able to do this and then develop into all kinds of crazy subspecies and all kinds of like different varieties of plants that all use the same system. And in osmosis, I'm not entirely dialed in on what that means. You can kind of break that down a little bit more. Yeah.
So it's like, I remember joking around in like high school or whatever, where it's like, I'm going to learn through osmosis. And it's like, you put your book under your pillow at night, and like, as you sleep, the knowledge will just seep into your brain, which doesn't actually work. But so osmosis is the other main way that water moves through plants. And so the easiest way to describe this, so this is like a chemical potential gradient, which, so what the heck does that mean? So essentially, imagine you have a permeable membrane. Like, so you have a tank of water and there's a membrane in the middle. And on one side of the tank, you have a really high concentration of salt. And on the other side of the tank, you do not have a high concentration of salt. So what will happen is, because that membrane is permeable, the water will move across the membrane to create an equal concentration on both sides, essentially, is what osmosis is. So the water moves to the place where there's more more solute or whatever to dilute it, essentially. So what will happen sometimes is the roots will have more sugars or whatever, more chemical compounds in them than the surrounding soil. And that will essentially pull the water in, because the water wants to move to that higher concentration of stuff. So
it's all the, like you said, like how water has a high, what was it, to make it draw itself to itself?
The cohesion. Yeah. So it holds itself to itself. So essentially, like, pulls itself in across that membrane of the root.
Yeah. So would water have to already exist there, or, because a plant should never be droughted, as we talked about earlier. And droughting, obviously, that's what that's what leads to damage, damaged cells. And so there, in a healthy plant, there almost will always be some form of water waiting on the other side of the membrane for this chemical process to happen.
Yeah. So osmosis. Do you mean outside of the root or inside of the root?
Interesting. I was thinking inside of the root going up the xylem. So there'll always be water there. The plant.
Yeah. If there's not, you have an air bubble and your plant's going to die.
Yeah.
So.
And that. Yeah. And so it's hard to think. But then, yeah, like if the root is where the water needs to come from, soil to root, then yeah, then that's just where, because the roots should also have some degree of water in them as well. And then that's where the chemical process, like that process, but the chemical balance is what you're saying. Like there's an imbalance caused.
Right. Yeah. So there's like, yeah. So like you have all the sugars that the plant has made, you know, move down to the roots for storage, but then that means that there's more of that sugar solution, whatever, inside of the root, and the water that's on the outside of the root will want to move into that space because of that chemical potential there. So it's more passive than, I feel like, transpiration. I mean, it's still a passive method of pulling water up and through, but it feels like it's a stronger force than, you know, like the osmosis of water just kind of slowly moving across a membrane. But they're both ways that water moves through the plant.
Something that kind of came up while you were talking about that, I'm thinking about the way that the water moves. And then for some reason, like we were joking about earlier about how plants are like bleed. And I was like, okay, so the xylem is where the water will be. And then the phloem is where the sap flow could be. So, because that's the nutrients pulling down.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to think about it? Because, and also is another thing is too, is it makes me think the sap in a pine tree is like very, very like tacky.
Mm-hmm.
But then the sap in a ficus tree is like that weird, weird milky
mm-hmm.
looking stuff. And then the sap in like an elm tree is just usually just, oh, actually the sap in an elm tree is like gel. It's like
ew.
Really weird looking. Like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like it comes out looking kind of weird. And then the sap in like, the only other one I can think of that has a clear sap is going to be like the bald cypress. Cause I was bending fresh growth today and I had a little bit of sap come out. It's clear and it looks like just water.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've also broke the sap line of a cypress tree too. And it's just always clear. Is there different things? I mean, obviously this is going to have to be broken down in different species of trees, but am I right in thinking that, is that the way it works, or am I kind of still off a little bit there with the way that where the sap is located? And then I guess, is there a way to go into why the sap is different in all these plants? Is that another thing we could talk about?
Yeah. So, right. So water moves up through the plant, through the xylem, but I don't think it's not just pure water. It's going to be essentially, you know, the sap. So there's going to be other compounds in it.
Does the mixture happen immediately, basically, when it's being pulled through the plant?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I'm thinking of like when you tap a maple tree for syrup, you're really getting, you know, the nutrients moving up the xylem through the tree. But that's, you know, it's sugary because it's moving nutrients up. So I think what we're doing is moving water and whatever else from the roots needs to go up versus phloem, which is more of a downward flow. So I think it's, you know, more directional as xylem's going up and phloem's going down. And then, you know, the main purpose of the xylem is to transport water, where the main purpose of the phloem is to bring nutrients down, but it's not 100% limited to
one or
just
the other.
Yeah. So like xylem's not always going to be like full of just water. It's going to have other stuff in it depending on the time of year.
Yeah.
And, you know, phloem is going to move probably, you know, more nutrients down in the fall when it's taking everything from the leaves down to the roots or wherever it's going for storage versus, you know, in the springtime, there's probably not going to be very much moving in there outside of, you know, whatever liquid solution is in there at the time. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. So it can be a mixture, but.
Well, yeah. I mean, the tissues are different, but the liquid inside of them. So the liquid inside of the xylem and the phloem is different, but they're not, neither of them is pure one thing or another thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you said different times of the year too. So. Because.
Mm-hmm.
There and like before I get too far into that,
uh-huh.
There was another question. I was like, okay, that's a good segue into different seasons. But is there an answer for the like different sap types against different species, or is that just you think it's just going to be?
I mean, there's some like, kind of evolutionary adaptation there. I'm not sure, you know, what it is for each species, but
because sap's obviously not the same in every single plant.
Right. Yeah. Everything has its own sap based on what it needs. And, you know, some of the saps are toxic to certain animals or people or whatever, whereas other saps are delicious. Like, and we put it on pancakes. So
it's like maple syrup versus poison ivy sap.
Right. Yeah.
If you break
the sap of poison ivy might not actually be the problem, but.
I think
yes,
it's the sap of sumac is the issue.
Those
can be
sap
pretty
of
bad.
A milkweed plant can be toxic to animals, which is why like monarch caterpillars eat it and then birds avoid them because they are essentially toxic because of the sap of that plant that they're eating. So
yeah,
I know that different becomes... evolutionary advantages create and then different compounds create that sap that is in the plant.
Yeah. And I know some some plants, especially like pines and junipers that exist in very alpine areas where it gets very, very cold, their sap also can prevent freezing to an extent, kind of like almost like a coolant in an engine.
Right. Yeah, because the higher concentration of something in water, it's going to lower the freezing point, right? Yeah. So, like, salt water is not going to freeze as fast as pure water. Or, like, where maples come in, like, sugar water isn't going to freeze as fast as plain water. So, it's essentially, it's antifreeze.
Yeah. And that's on junipers and pines. I mean, that kind of segues into the question I was going to have earlier was, so if there's different times of the year and there's different things happening during the process of water uptake, pines and junipers and evergreen plants can move nutrients and water basically all year long, right? So when a deciduous tree is dormant,
yes,
what happens there?
So this is more of the osmosis part of water movement where, I mean, the whole thing slows down metabolically. So there's not really much going on, but especially early in the spring before they have leaves. So there's not really any transpiration happening to pull the water up. They use that concentration of sugars and whatever in their roots and other parts of the plant to pull the water from the soil into the root. So that's really where osmosis is a major, major player, especially for deciduous plants, is getting the jump start in the spring when there aren't leaves to create that tension to pull the water up. It's just all the stored sugars and whatever on, you know, on the inside the root that pull the water in from the soil.
Yeah. So they will still absorb water to a certain extent, but they're not growing, they're not manufacturing photosynthesis. But I think we had talked about the last episode, last time we had talked about photosynthesis on episode 65, you'd mentioned that even branches and stems can be photosynthetic.
Yeah, there's chloroplasts even in woody tissues. There's not a lot, but there's some. And also remember that all of the buds, like inside the buds, the leaves and the flowers and everything are fully formed. They just haven't expanded. It's like a butterfly in a chrysalis, right? Like when the butterfly comes out, it has to spend some time like getting the water into its wings so that it can fly away. So it's like, like with a leaf, as the movement starts in the spring, the water comes up the tree and kind of expands everything. It's more of like cell elongation and opening than like necessarily creating a whole bunch of stuff right away.
So the buds, in theory, on a deciduous tree, especially on buds that are a lot more obvious, let's say like a beech, those could be, because they have chloroplasts in them, they could, in theory, be dealing with water uptake and creating photosynthesis in the dormancy period.
Is that possible? Maybe a little bit, but the temperature is so low that not much is going to happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, because they're not going to like move the water enough to extend the leaves, like you said, but there will be just enough to keep the small, tiny little processes of photosynthesis and water uptake in equilibrium.
I think so. I don't know how dormant a plant goes in the winter, if it totally stops or if it just is severely reduced.
I don't think it's a severe standstill because...
No, I mean, it can't stop because it's still respiring, but it definitely goes way down based on temperature and light availability and just not having a ton of chloroplasts around.
From my thought process, then, it kind of like we're oversimplifying it because, I mean, I didn't go to college for this, so my brain has to think very simply and very smooth, is that like when plants go dormant, like for especially for deciduous trees, it's like they put themselves into like super slow-mo. Basically, all the stuff's ready to go, but since the light availability, length of day, and moisture might even be a slowdown for some certain species, they will still, everything will be moving still, but it'll be moving really, really slow. It's kind of how it helps me kind of think about, you know, because I'll pull up I'll pull up like an elm, a maple, a cypress, and during repotting season, and the roots are growing and the roots are active during dormancy. So there is stuff happening, but it's much, much slower from what
Yeah,
I can.
well, and even so photosynthesis is making the food, right? So there's not a whole ton of food being made, but it's storing all the food that it made last year and using that. So a plant's always respiring, which is essentially using the energy. So photosynthesis is making the energy, respiring is using the energy to grow and do whatever processes it needs to do. So it's like for us, photosynthesis is eating, right? And respiring is just all the other stuff that we do to live. It's using all of that food energy that we ate, if that makes sense. So it's definitely still respiring, whether or not it's photosynthesizing as much. And especially in the springtime, that kicks into high gear because it has to make all the new leaves and all the new stuff. So it's using a lot of that stored sugar from the previous year.
Yeah. It's just crazy to me because, like, I think about all this stuff that now that we're going into more and more about how plants work, and we're breaking down all these little things, and it's little things where we're cons I want to make considerations for all the things that plants need and the way that they work. And I know that, and this is something I had to like kind of think about early on. It was like plants that also, like, I got my hands on a little book. It's a little like plants fact book. It taught me what the coded of plants are. Which was really cool. I was like, oh, that gives me a lot of insight into how plants heal and stuff. And then another thing that I was reading was like, plants don't regenerate, they generate only. So they generate new branches, leaves, and shoots and whatever. And it's just crazy to think that like if we cut back a branch, it will generate new growth, but it's taking all that nutrient and all that water and all that, all the starches and sugars for photosynthesis, and it's building new pieces of itself. It's not like a lizard's tail where it pops off and it grows back again, somewhat similar to how it was before. And I'm just like, it blows my mind to think that like I cut back a tree and then the balancing energy, like we cut back from a single branch after I've gotten the size of the branch I need, and I cut it back, and then I think about energy balance and how the plant is able to establish two new, or sometimes it's more than just two, depending on the if you have a whorl on like on an oak tree or an azalea versus a trident maple where it's just opposite, or if it's an elm where it's alternating, it's able to channel those new, basically that new vascular system to build that new branch structure to refine itself and balance the energy as we go. It helps. It starts connecting all these pieces and all these dots. So it's just, yeah, making little connections here, opening literal new pathways in my mind how to think about bonsai and how they develop too. So anyway.
Well, and just to remind everybody, this is we're just really talking about water in this episode. How nutrients are taken up
Is way
is a
different.
different story.
Yeah.
There's other interesting pathways. Some of them are more active than, how water moves in and through something. Nutrient uptake is a different story with active processes and enzymatic stuff and all that. So we'll talk about that in further detail too at another time. But I was, as I was going through this, I was like, okay, but at what point does the, how is the nitrogen brought in and how is the da 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 brought in? And so that becomes kind of a different animal than just thinking H2O.
So that's kind of that wraps us up pretty well right there with the water uptake. So like you were alluding to, we will get to nutrient moving, move like process of moving nutrients, because water is water. There's other things that exist. There's a reason why we don't just water. And then something that a lot of people don't do very often. Unfortunately, when I meet like a beginner in bonsai, they say they don't fertilize their trees very often. That's kind of it's kind of ridiculous to me because I'm thinking about all the fertilizer that I use during the spring.
Yeah.
I'm using all these different methods to get these trees nutrients. And I'm like, oh, if you're not even fertilizing, that's where we need to start from the most simple block of how that works. And so I think it would also be useful for us to just do an episode in the near future, just talking about how to fertilize your trees again. I think we might have talked about that a little bit in the past, but I think talking about why and how organic fertilizers and synthetic fertilizers and plants that naturally fix their own nitrogen in the atmosphere type things work, and like that really needs to go into detail. So
yeah,
so that plants can get their vitamins, because they can't just feed them a vitamin like we would do to ourselves or to our child. They literally have to have it handed to them. But we can talk about that. And I feel like
I put little Flintstone vitamins right on top of the soil. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Just to help them through the day, you know. No. But it needs to be aired out a little bit more as before we get to that section. But I think I'm not sure how many science episodes we will do. But thank you guys for listening to today's
science.
But I feel like there's more. Much
well,
more.
There's always more.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was, I cut a lot of stuff. I was looking at all this stuff being like, okay, they don't need to know about that specific scientific term. They don't need to know about how that electron moves over there. So, I mean, this goes way further. But just, you know, trying to generally speaking, so that everybody can kind of get on the same page, at least with water movement. And dear friends, if I said something wrong, please correct me. Yeah. And or if you have other questions about water movement in plants, or if you want us to cover something specific about
science?
Yeah. Let us know. So yeah. It's been a long time since I was in school. So, you know, sometimes I forget things.
Yeah, it's been a while. We are in our 30s, and high school and college seems like forever ago now.
Oh, boy.
Yep. So we'll make a post that will go alongside this on our Instagram. You go over to Little Things on Instagram. It's going to be Little Things for Bonsai People. And we're going to make a post. It's going to show pictures of roots, like Carmen said. And then you can go over there and comment on that link, or not on that link, but on that post on Instagram. And you can say stuff like, oh, this is what I wanted to know more about, you know, photosynthesis or the way that water uptake works. And then, like you said, Carmen said, like, recommendations, like what you guys want to talk about, what you guys want to hear about an upcoming science type episodes. I know it's to some people, it might not be the most exciting subject matter, but some other people geek out about it. Like I get really into it. So
I'm geeking.
I know there's other people out there that are interested in this. So we're going to keep doing them because they're important. They're building blocks to understanding our bonsai better. And we step away from the aesthetics so much, and we do more the learning, the things that I don't think it's talked about enough in bonsai world.
So
what is the rest of this month look like? I know I have our next guest is coming up next week.
Ooh.
I'll go ahead and just put it out there. I've already asked him to be on. I know who it is. It's going to be a guy from Texas. I talked to him my last visit when I went over to give workshops and lectures, and I was fortunate enough to meet him and go to his own garden. It was awesome going to see someone else's collection, and it gives you insight if you go to see another person's collection of trees and their plants and how they're taking care of their trees. But the most intriguing thing to me was that he was working with a lot of Texas natives. And so I wanted to go into a deeper dive with Joey McCoy next week about Texas natives. And they're close to our plants. But what I'm hoping to do is, as I go on, I want to find somebody in another area. Hopefully when I go to St. Louis at the end of this month, I can find another person who does native plants in their range, and maybe we can talk to them. Cause that was something I was mentioning to somebody else earlier this week. And I was like, this was the original intention of this podcast when it was called Bonsai Southeast, was that I wanted to feature Southeast natives and talk about them in depth. But wouldn't you know that it's difficult to find people that do that? Sadly, there's not a lot of people doing it. And there's not people like me that really pour a lot of thought and time and energy into like native species that I still think are underutilized. So, so it was really cool getting to see that. And I know it'll be a good episode and eye opening for a lot of people. And if you guys know of other native plant experts in your range or area, direct them our way as well. I'd love to talk to them about how they work with their natives. So, and I'm sure you could think of some people too, Carmen. So,
yeah, I have a couple in mind.
Yep. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. But anyway, thank you guys for tuning in this week. We'll go ahead and do the little shout outs we usually do. So for me, you can go over to underhillbonsai.com. And I'm going to be updating my galleries pretty soon here. I'm going to be trying to take some good photos of my trees that I'm currently working on and things that I've got going on. I got some blog posts on Underhill as well that you can go look at. I'm trying to write more. It's difficult how busy I've been. But then you can go to Underhill Bonsai Store and you can go check out the stuff that we have available there. We will be adding new bonsai, pre-bonsai stock to our store really soon here. Also, we just put all of our Joshua Roth tools into our system online, so you can purchase Joshua Roth tools through our website. We ship within the United States right now. I don't know about international shipping in the future, but we'll see when we get there. And then you can also go to the Little Things tab on underhillbonsaistore.com, and we have the black long sleeve shirts that says I'm into heavy metal. The Joshua Roth collaborative shirts are still there. We still have a handful of sizes left in those shirts, and they're comfy. They're, you know, we're past cool weather, but who doesn't like a long sleeve shirt when they're just chilling at their house too? So, and for you, Carmen, where can they go check out your stuff?
You can find me on Instagram at Becoming Bonsai. I'm also on Facebook. And check out the Purple Pot Society, the National Women's Bonsai Group that works to encourage and educate women in bonsai. We are at purplepotsociety.org. Also on Instagram at Purple Pot Society.
Yep. And I am a member of the Purple Pot Society, so you don't have to be female to support. Anybody can support. And then for Mike... Mike Lane, you go over to kitsunebonsai.com, see what his seasonal offerings are. I know he's running a lot of online classes and in-person workshops that he's conducting throughout South Florida and sometimes up into the higher parts of, you know, it's the panhandle. And then he's also, he was also our featured artist at our Say Bonsai event. So Mike is open for booking now that baby Amelia is a little bit more established in the family, and they're doing they're starting to be able to be a little bit more flexible. So you can reach out to Mike at kitsunebonsai.com and get Mike in your local area. He's a great teacher. So anyway, any closing remarks?
No.
Yeah, okay. Simple, easy. This is the beginning of a really busy month. So we'll see where we are next week. And we'll be talking, like I said, to our next special guest. We'll hear from you guys next time. Well, you guys will hear from us next time. Thank you for tuning in.
Bye now.